Class 3 of the North Balfour Ecclesial Park. The general theme of this series is Blessed Faithful Abraham. The title of this class is A Father of Many Nations Have I Made. Our opening reading was Genesis 17. We now call upon Brother Jim Cowie to lead us in this class.
Bring the whole thing out. Thanks, Dan. Brothers and sisters and young people, we've come now to have a look at what really is another marvellous chapter in the life of Abraham. They're all marvellous, aren't they? And this one's particularly good because it involves you and me very, very personally because, brothers and sisters, this is where God changed Abram's name to Abraham to incorporate you and me. A father of a multitude of nations have I made thee. And here we are. We're the evidence that that is still happening. And God is still at work to produce a multitudinous seed for Abraham. We can be very thankful about that. Let's just firstly sort out the times of Abraham. Did you notice in verse 1 it told us that he was 99 when God makes his fifth appearance. And that's what it is, his fifth appearance to Abraham to make his fifth promise. Did you notice he's 99? Have a look at the previous verse. Genesis chapter 16. And verse 16, it tells us, and Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bare Ishmael to Abram. So he was 86. So 13 years have passed between the last verse of chapter 16 and the first verse of chapter 17, and we're not told one word about what happened in that 13 years. Now, wouldn't you be interested to know? Well, I would like to know some things, but God says, no, no, no. You don't need to know anything about that period of Abraham's life. There's slow development going on here. But I'm not telling you a thing about it because it's not important. What is important is what follows from chapter 17 to 21. Because the remarkable thing is that chapter 17 to 21 all occur in just 1 year. So we hear nothing at all about 13 years. We get 5 chapters about 1 year. That demonstrates to you just how important this little section is. So he left Haran, age 75. He was 85. Just keep that in mind. He was 85 when he was declared righteous on the basis of his faith, his belief in what God said to him, so shall thy seed be. Ishmael is born about 12 months later. He's 86. Then we come to chapter 17. He's 99. He's at Hebron all of this time. Not a word, not a single word about it. He gets the fifth promise at age 99, and then when he's 100 years of age, we're told in Genesis 21 that Isaac was born. Exactly 12 months after this visitation, the fifth visitation by the angel. Now, what is that all about? Well, we want to demonstrate. We want to explore what that's about. In Genesis 17, verse 21, we read this. But my covenant will I establish with Isaac, which Sarah shall bear unto thee at this set time in the next year. So it's exactly 12 months from Genesis 17 to 21, from this appearance to the birth of Isaac. Now that's extremely important because, of course, Sarah is going to have a child through Abraham. And so there has to be a normal gestation period of 9 months, 10 days, which leaves about 2.5 months for God to bring Sarah's faith up to where Abraham's faith is. That's not much time, is it? In our study, our final study for today, and you really put on a pretty heavy day here, don't you? You know, 4 studies in a day, plus a family activity afternoon. It's a pretty heavy day. But our final study tonight will be all about what God does. He blows Sodom and Gomorrah off the face of the earth to bring Sarah's faith up to where it needs to be for the conception of Isaac, the child of faith. You know that? That's why he declares himself in Genesis 17 verse 1 as El Shaddai. That's the title he gives himself. First time you read this title in our Bibles is Genesis 17 and verse 1. So this is the fifth promise. Abraham is 99, the number of finality and fullness. He's reached a certain point in life. Yahweh appeared to him. Fifth appearance, probably, doubtless, Michael the archangel. And I'm going to demonstrate that to you as well. And say that with a high degree of certainty. This is Michael the archangel, because he actually calls himself Yahweh in the next chapter. Okay? He's called the angel of Yahweh's presence in Isaiah 63 and verse 9. So when he's sent, God's there. He's the angel of God's presence. You notice in verse 1 it says that Yahweh appeared to Abram and said unto him, I am Almighty God, El Shaddai. The first of 48 occurrences of that divine title in the Old Testament. It refers here, brothers and sisters, to its primary meaning. Whenever you meet this name, this title of God, El Shaddai, its primary meaning is of the builder and nourisher of a family. However, as you're going to see when we examine this title, it also has the idea of being a destroyer. And its final occurrence is in Joel chapter 1 verse 15, where it's clearly about God being a destroyer. Okay, so there's these two aspects of it, primarily about building a family. But if God has to destroy in order to build his family, he will. And that's what he does. He destroys Sodom and Gomorrah in order to build his family through a faithful Sarah who has the same faith as her husband Abraham. She doesn't have that faith at the end of Genesis 17. She doesn't have it at the end of Genesis 18. She has it at the end of Genesis 20 in the remarkable events that occur. God works in people's lives, brothers and sisters, where his purpose is involved. He can work quite quickly. It took him 2.5 months, and he got Sarah where he wanted her. This is what he says to Abraham in verse 1. I am El Shaddai, the builder and nourisher of a family. Walk before me, and be thou perfect. Now in the Hebrew, halak panim means, literally, walk as though in my presence. Panim, faces. Walk as though in my presence. And that, brothers and sisters, is our calling, isn't it? Walk as though you're in God's presence. And be thou perfect. Well, none of us can be perfect. Hands up anybody here that's perfect. You put your hand up, you're in trouble. Okay? Nobody's here is perfect. It doesn't mean perfect per se. The word in the Hebrew is tamim, and it means entire or complete. Now bear in mind, brothers and sisters, that Abraham was baptized at age 75. He's now 99. He's been 24 years in the truth. How many people have been in the truth for 24 years or more? Here, I can put my hand up. I'm getting close to 50. Anybody? Well, there's a few. Yeah. Well, God said that Abraham was ready for this role that he's going to give him when he'd been in the truth for 24 years. This is why Paul says you don't put greenhorns in positions of responsibility. You don't make greenhorns fathers of the ecclesia. You wait until God's worked in their life and they've had a bit of experience and a bit of biblical knowledge that they can apply it. All right, he waits 24 years before he gives to Abraham the responsibilities that he's going to pass on to him. And guess what he's going to pass on? He's going to delegate to Abraham his own fatherhood. Yeah, so you can see why he's waiting. And you can see why he says, you walk as though you're in my presence and be complete, because I'm going to delegate to you my fatherhood. And you don't mess around with that. Got a picture? That's why this chapter is very, very important. So what about El Shaddai? First occurrence, Genesis 17:1. Links it with the Abrahamic covenant and Yahweh's delegated fatherhood, which we'll explore in a moment in Romans chapter 4. Shaddai is derived from Shad, the breast, like a mother nourishing a baby. But it also evidently comes, as Brother Thomas points out, from Shadad, which means burly or powerful, hence to devastate or to destroy. So we can have these two aspects. And this is the wonder of its first use in the scriptures, brothers and sisters, because both of those aspects are there. You've got God setting about to build his family, but to do that he has to blow Sodom and Gomorrah off the face of the earth. Its primary meaning is clearly, wherever you look, its primary meaning is the strength of the nourishers, building of the divine family. And both aspects, as I said, are revealed here in this wonderful context from Genesis 17 to 19, with the single aim to build God's family. So let's have a look at the delegation of Yahweh's fatherhood to Abraham. But before we go to Romans chapter 4, I want you to just quickly read with me again what he says to him in verses 4 and 5. He says, "As for me, behold, my covenant is with thee, and thou shalt be a father of many nations, Hamon Goyim." In other words, a multitude of nations. "Neither shall thy name any more be called Abram," which means a lofty or exalted father, where of course the flesh is put on a pedestal, "but thy name shall be called Abraham, the father of a multitude." That's what that means, the father of a multitude. And he adds, he says, "for a father of many nations." In actual fact, the word many is hamon, multitude. It should read, "the father of a multitude of nations have I made thee." So here is Abraham delegated with God's own fatherhood. God is the builder, the nourisher, the family. He's the father. But he says to Abraham, "Now listen, I'm going to delegate my fatherhood to you. You are going to be the father of a multitude of nations." That's exactly what Paul says. If you come to Romans chapter 4, Paul says this in the fourth chapter of Romans, which is that chapter, of course, that deals with Abraham being imputed with righteousness by faith. Romans chapter 4, and we're going to pick it up at verse 16. And I'll come back to this a little later on, as you can see why. Verse 16 of Romans 4, "Therefore it is of faith, that it might be by grace, to the end the promise might be sure to all the seed, Jew and Gentile, not to that only which is of the law, Jew, but to that also which is of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all." So he's called the father of the faithful. Then we read this in verse 17. Now, do you notice that verse 17 starts with a parenthesis? There's a bracket there. You see that? "As it is written." So what Paul is saying in verse 17 is explanatory of what he's just said in verse 16. "As it is written, I have made thee a father of many nations." So he's quoting, as you clearly can see, from Genesis chapter 17 and verse 5. Direct quotation. That's his quotation in brackets. And then he says, "Before him whom he believed, even God, who quickeneth or makes alive the dead, and calls those things which be not as though they were." Now this phrase, "before him," in the King James Version, is just one Greek word, katananti. It means down, over, against. That is, in the sight and estimation of. Hence, he was like unto God. That is, he was allowed to stand in his presence as the father of the divine family. So get a picture of this, brothers and sisters. Here's God the Father saying, "I'm El Shaddai. I'm going to build a family. I'm going to nourish it. But here, Abraham, you're standing down over against me. You're inferior, but I'm delegating to you my fatherhood. That's why I want you to walk as though you're in my presence and be complete. You can't do this job if you're not those things. That's why I've had to wait for 24 years. You weren't ready for this earlier on. I waited because now I've got you where I think you can take this role on." Then he hands him a knife and says, "Hey, cut your flesh off. Circumcise your flesh. You want to lead in the ecclesia, brethren? People must be able to see that in your life you have cut off the flesh. You haven't cut off the flesh. You are not eligible for ecclesial leadership. Period, as you say in this country." It's as simple as that. That's the lesson we learn from Genesis chapter 17. So here you've got God handing Abraham a knife, commanding him to cut off his flesh. This is where circumcision is introduced. Because you see, that is what's required for someone who takes on the delegated fatherhood of God. I want you to come to Isaiah 51. Let's just lock this down, shall we? This is what God's talking about. Isaiah chapter 51. In verse 1 we read, "Hearken to me, ye that follow after righteousness." That's an interesting introduction, isn't it? "Ye that seek Yahweh, look unto the rock when ye are hewn, to the hole of the pit when ye are digged," like a well. So who are they? Who is represented here? By the rock and the well that God has dug. Well, we know, we're told. Verse 2. "Look unto Abraham, your father." There he is. He's the father. He's got God's delegated fatherhood delivered to him. "Your father, the father of the faithful. And unto Sarah that bare you. For I called him alone. I started with one man. I'm going to finish with a multitude. And blessed him." That is, I set about to redeem him, as we saw this morning. That's what blessing means in the divine terminology. "I turned his iniquities away from him. I made him so he's complete. He'd cut the flesh off." Yes. "And increased him." Now, how do we know? How do we know that this is God saying that Abraham and Sarah are our spiritual father and mother? Well, he tells us in the next verse. But let's just analyse what's being said here. Abraham, our father of the faithful, like Paul's Sarah, is described as the mother of us all. Galatians chapter 4, verses 22 to 26, you have, of course, that wonderful allegory that the Apostle Paul presents. And in Isaiah 54, she's spoken of as being Zion, our mother. So she's the mother of us all. And of course she represents the Abrahamic covenant, doesn't she? So we've got a father, a covenant father, Abraham, and we've got a mother. The covenants, represented by Sarah herself. So there we are, brothers and sisters. Now how do you prove that? Well, look at verse 3. "For Yahweh shall comfort Zion." Think about that. Just cast your eyes back to the beginning of verse 2. "Look unto Abraham your father." So who's the real father? Well, Yahweh. He delegates his fatherhood to Abraham. "And unto Sarah that bare you." Well, who's she? Well, she's Zion. See, so verse 3 explains verse 2. Yahweh, the father, represented by Abraham. And Zion, the mother, represented by Sarah. So there's a description in the very passage itself of what this means. So have a look at this equation on the screen here. Abraham, your father, representing Yahweh. Sarah, Zion, the covenants of promise and the things that have to do with Zion. That's the equation. Now, just a brief word about the divine allegory of Galatians 4. You may or may not want to turn it up. That's up to you. I'm not going to spend too much time on it. It's pretty well known. In Galatians 4, verses 22 to 31, Paul uses Genesis 16 and 17 as the basis of an allegory, doesn't he? He points out that Hagar represents the Mosaic covenant. She has a son. She's a bondmaid. She has a bondmaid son called Ishmael, who represents Israel living under law. So Jews living under the bondage of law are represented by one man, Ishmael. Yeah. He's circumcised in the flesh like the Jews were, but not in heart. He was circumcised, by the way, at the age of 13, and 13 is the number of rebellion. So that tells you something about it, doesn't it? And then on the other side of this equation, you've got Sarah. She represents the Abrahamic covenant. She has a son. She's free woman. She has a free-born son, born by faith, by the power of the Spirit. He represents spiritual Israel under grace. He's circumcised in heart as well as in flesh. He's a Jew inwardly, as Paul puts it in Romans chapter 2. Now, how did that allegory come about? Well, I'll tell you how it came about. It came about by Abraham's mistake. He listened to the voice of his wife, who said, "Well, look, God mentioned nothing about who the mother of this seed would be that he promised you in Genesis 15. So why don't you take Hagar, my handmaid, and produce children for me through her?" Wrong. That should never have happened, brothers and sisters. Abraham should never have listened to his wife in that manner. Ishmael should never have been born. Simple as that. It was a disaster. Right from the very outset, it's an absolute disaster. But you know, that's the thing about our God, isn't it? Nothing is too hard for Yahweh. He can make the most beautiful allegory out of human stupidity. Simple as that. He can take man's mess and make something beautiful out of it. Even as he does here. Now I want you to come back to the As For chapter, to Genesis 17. If you haven't got this mark, it's well worth doing it. Genesis 17 is the as for chapter. And you'll see what I mean as we proceed. So here in verse 4 of Genesis 17, Yahweh begins, before he changes the name of Abraham, he begins with these words, as for me. And guarantees, of course, his involvement in the outcome. He's going to complete this family, verses 4 to 8. He talks about that. He says, I will be their God and they shall be my people. That language occurs 7 times in the prophets, brothers and sisters. 7, the covenant number. And whenever you read that language, it's about the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. I will be their God and they shall be my people. Have a look at verse 9. And God said unto Abraham, this is what the King James says. It says, thou shalt keep my covenant, therefore. But if you go to the literal translations, this is the way it should be rendered. But as for thee. So in verse 4, God says, as for me, this is my part. In verse 9, he says, Abraham, as for thee, this is what I want you to do. Here's a knife. Go and cut your flesh off. When you come to verse 14, we read this. And the uncircumcised man-child in whose flesh, of his foreskin, is not circumcised, that soul should be cut off from his people. He hath broken my covenant. In the literal Hebrew, it should read, but as for the uncircumcised male. So we've got God in verse 4 of himself. Then we've got Abraham in verse 9. Then we've got the uncircumcised male of verse 14. And it goes on like that. Look at verse 15. And God said unto Abraham, as for Sarai, thy wife, we're going to change her name as well. So he addresses her. She must have Abraham's faith. And of course she doesn't have it. And in verse 16 we read, I will bless her, because I've got to go through a process with this lady, and I'll give thee a son. She's not ready to produce the son of promise. She does not have your faith about this matter yet, Abraham, as you're going to see. I know that. So I'm going to have to go through a process with her, because she's going to become a mother of nations and kings of people shall be of her. But it's going to be painful for a while, for the next 2.5 months, at least. Then we come to verse 20. And as for Ishmael, because you see, Abraham says, well, oh, that Ishmael might live before thee in verse 18. And God says, yeah, okay, we'll include him as well. As for Ishmael. See what he's done here. This is the as for chapter. As for me, as for Abraham, as for the uncircumcised man, as for Sarai, as for Ishmael. He's dealing with each one in turn, brothers and sisters. And of course, what that implies is he deals with us as well. Now what about this covenant of circumcision? It was introduced to demonstrate the method of participation in the Abrahamic promise. It's no different for you and me, essentially. Circumcision preceded the law of Moses. Christ makes that point in John 7. It was the seal of imputed righteousness by faith. Paul makes that point in Romans 4, 9-11. When was Abraham, he asks, justified by faith? When he was circumcised? No. When he was uncircumcised. He was justified in Genesis 15. When's he circumcised? Genesis 17. Right? It typically foreshadowed baptism into Christ. And that was to be translated into a way of life. Now I think I should refer to this one. Colossians chapter 2 verses 11-13. Because you see, brothers and sisters, and I say that deliberately, brothers and sisters, we've all, if we're baptized, we've all been circumcised in the spiritual sense of that term. And we find that out from Colossians chapter 2. Colossians 2, we're going to read from verse 11. He's talking about Jesus Christ, in whom, he says, also ye are circumcised with the circumcision made without hands, in putting off of the body of the sins of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ. Now how does that happen? Well, he tells you in verse 12, buried with him in baptism, wherein also ye are risen with him through the faith of the operation of God who hath raised him from the dead. So when I got baptized, brothers and sisters, I was circumcised. And we're not talking anything here about the literal circumcision of baby boys, because this kind of circumcision applies equally with females. This is spiritual circumcision. When you're baptized into Christ, you were circumcised in the terms of the scripture. And so, of course, when you have circumcision, literal circumcision, introduced in Genesis 17, it's clear what that means. It's pointing forward to you and me being involved in the promises made to Abraham by baptism into Christ. That's what it's pointing forward. But it also, of course, highlights a simple fact. This is the chapter where God says to Abraham, walk as though in my presence and be complete. In other words, I want you to cut your flesh off. That is what circumcision really is about in life. I don't think that's too hard to understand, is it? When the Bible's allowed to explain itself, it's pretty simple, isn't it? Very, very simple. So it's intended to be an outward sign of an inward change. That's why Paul talks about Jews inwardly. He says, well, the Jews, they were circumcised. They did all sorts of things, but they weren't circumcised in heart. Ishmael was circumcised in the flesh, but not in the heart. And that's where the circumcision has got to be. So, I want you to come back to Romans 4. You got a bit of a feel how important Romans 4 is in the life of Abraham? Well, you're going to get a real sense of that now. If you can focus, if you're going to allow a little bit of blood to go to your brain, that is now going to your stomach after lunch, in what's called the graveyard shift for speakers, you just allow a little bit of blood to go to your brain. I'm going to just tease it a bit. Okay? I'm just going to tease your brain a bit. In Romans 4, brothers and sisters, Paul quotes Genesis 15, verse 6, and it was imputed unto him for righteousness in verse 18. You in Romans 4 with me? Verse 18. At the end of the verse, so that that which was spoken, so shall thy seed be. He's quoting from Genesis chapter 15 and verse 6 in the context of him being imputed with righteousness. He quotes from Genesis 17 verse 5 in verse 17. We've just read that one, haven't we? As it is written, I have made thee a father of many nations. So you've got two quotations from Genesis. One from chapter 15 verse 6 and one from chapter 17 verse 5. So how many years apart is this? 14. Because in Genesis chapter 15, Abraham was 85. In Genesis chapter 17, he's 99. When I went to school, there's 14 years between them. Okay? That's pretty simple, isn't it? Well, the name Abraham occurs in Romans 4. And let me just point out that God didn't put the chapter divisions in. They were put in the Middle Ages, by the way. So they're not God's invention. But it's clear that the translators have got the chapter divisions pretty well right here. That Romans 4 is a context in its own right, stands alone in its own right. In that context, Abraham occurs seven times, only nine times in the whole book of Romans. Seven of them are here, in Romans chapter 4. The term father occurs seven times in Romans 4, 12 in the whole book of Romans. The term circumcision and circumcised occur collectively together seven times in Romans chapter 4. Uncircumcised and uncircumcision occurs five times in aggregate. And in verse 16 we read this, and this is the literal translation you can see on the screen. Wherefore, out of faith, that according to grace it might be. So what's the number of grace? Five. Yep, you got that one right. Five's the number of grace. Okay. So this is all about Abraham being delegated with God's fatherhood to produce a multitude of nations upon the basis of faith, that they might have the grace of God. Isn't that interesting? Because at five, all right, we've got seven, the covenant number, five's the number of grace, and this is 14 years between the two quotations are made. Here he's imputed with righteousness. Here his name is changed to involve the Gentile peoples. When I went to school, if you multiplied 5 times 14, 5 grace by 14, you got 70. Which just happens to be the number of the nations. I have made thee a father of a multitude of nations. Proof? Genesis 10, count the names, 70. Exodus 15, 27, 12 wells of water. At Elam, the place of the mighty ones. Vision of the kingdom, 12 wells of water. How many palm trees? 70. Go to Luke chapter 9 verse 1. sending forth 12 disciples two by two. Luke 10, verse 1. How many? 70. 12, 70. It's the number of the nations. Got a picture? Yeah. Come back to Genesis 17. So Abraham's name is changed, that he might accept the responsibility of God's delegated fatherhood. So what does God do? Look at verse 5. Neither shall thy name any more be called Abram, but thy name should be Abraham. So what God does is he adds the fifth letter of the Hebrew alphabet, which has a numerical value of 5. So each of the Hebrew alphabet letters, the 22 of them, have a number attached to them. So Aleph is 1, Beth is 2, so on it goes down. Each has got a number attached to them. That's why we can do what they call gematria. You know what gematria is? You can work out the numerical value of every single word, every single sentence in the Bible. That's got a numerical value to it. Now why would God use the two languages where this happens, Hebrew and Greek? Well, because he's actually underscored it, brothers and sisters. There is a pattern of sevens through all of the scripture. Why seven? Well, it's covenant, true, but seven's also the spirit number. God is saying, this is my book, don't fiddle with it. I've done this. You know, man's tried to recreate the patterns of sevens with a computer and never achieved it. They've tried it. So you see, he doesn't mess around with numbers. He puts the fifth letter of the Hebrew alphabet with a numerical value of 5 in the fifth position of Abram's name. Abram has a numerical value of 243. Abraham has a numerical value of 248. If you use the right text, the name Abraham occurs 248 times in the Bible. That's perfectly accidental. Yeah. Abraham, or Abram, has 5 letters, 4 consonants and 1 vowel. Abraham has 7 letters, the number of the covenant, 5 consonants and 2 vowels. There is structure there. I want to come back to that in a moment, because you see he does the same thing, virtually the same thing, with Sarai's name. But there is a distinct difference, an important difference, as we shall see. As for Sarai, well, come over to verses 15 and 16 with me. And God said unto Abraham, as for Sarai thy wife, thou shalt not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall her name be. Now, anybody know what Sarai means? Not Sarah, Sarai. Means dominating. Yeah, like she did in Genesis 16 when she said, you take Hagar to be your wife. Oh, yes, dear. She dominated, and he fell for it. Now her name's going to be changed. To Sarah. What does it mean? A princess. Last time I read a book, a princess is always subject to a prince. Now she's subject. She's not dominating anymore. I want to show you the importance of this. So, the point being made here, as he says in verse 16, the point is that he can't bring forth Isaac from Sarah while she doesn't have Abraham's faith concerning that promise. You've got to believe in that which is humanly impossible. She didn't believe that God could do that which was humanly impossible in her case. In Luke chapter 1, brothers and sisters, we just read this in our daily readings, haven't we? We have the divine pattern that demanded that Sarah acquire Abram's faith concerning the promised seed. Because when Gabriel came to Mary and he said to her, that holy thing that should be born of thee should be called the Son of God, she asked a question. Well, I've not known a man. How can this be? And she's told, the Holy Spirit shall overshadow thee. Yes, God's going to work on thee. You don't have to have the intervention of a man, Mary, she said. Behold the handmaid of the Lord. I'm ready. I believe it. And so she was ready. Not Sarah. Sarah didn't believe it. She's got to go through a lot of pain to get to that point. But God will not bring forth Isaac, who's the type of his son, until she has Abraham's faith on this matter. It's an impossibility. He has to form Christ in Sarah. as Paul, he does that in Genesis 18, by the way, there and thereafter. As Paul says in Galatians 4, verse 19, my little children, of whom I travail in birth again, until Christ be formed in you. That child that was in her womb was a type of Christ. Going to only be born by faith. And the events of Genesis 18 to 21 are designed to accomplish that in just 2.5 months. That's the amazing thing that happens. That's why Sodom and Gomorrah is destroyed in that period of time, as we shall see. Sarah's submission is memorialised by her name, the change of her name. What does he do to her name? Well, as we pointed out, 5 is the biblical number of grace. In verse 15, Yahweh replaced the 5th letter of Sarai's name with a new numerical value of 10. That was the numerical value of the letter he replaces. Recall, he actually popped one into Abraham's name, but not here. He takes one out of hers and replaces it with the 5th letter of the Hebrew alphabet with a numerical value of 5. So the end result is this. Sarai has a numerical value of 510. It has 5 letters, 3 consonants and 2 vowels. Sarah has a numerical value of 505. That's because, you see, he's taken out one letter with a numerical value of 10 and replaced it with one, the 5th letter of the alphabet, with a numerical value of 5. So she's gone down by 5. Sarah has 5 letters, 3 consonants, 2 vowels. So there's no change in the structure. But it memorialises a change in Sarah. The net result, I want you to come to 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7. We're just going to have a look at the context very briefly. 1 Peter 3, verses 1 to 7. Context, verse 1. Wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not the word, they may also without a word, not the word, you don't win anybody without the word, without a word, in other words, don't nag him, be won by the way of life of the wives. And he goes on to talk about Sarah. He brings her into the picture in verse 5. For after this manner in the old time, the holy women also, who trusted in God, adorned themselves, being in subjection unto their own husbands. Even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters ye are, as long as ye do well, and are not afraid with any terror, as that word amazement means. Terror or consternation. So what's Peter talking about, brothers and sisters? What's his context? An unbelieving husband. Now, who would you produce in this context as an example of someone who didn't give his wife the support that he should have? Who would you introduce? Well, I know who Peter introduces under inspiration. Abraham. Who on 2 occasions, in Egypt, told a lie, and in the land of the Philistines, to Abimelech, told the same lie, which ended up with the same result. His wife goes into the harem of a foreign monarch and God has to intervene to save her. Yeah. Peter brings into the picture Abraham as a failure in this matter. And this is what he says in verse 7. Likewise, ye husbands, dwell with them? Yeah, she was in the house of Pharaoh and then Abimelech. Dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honour to the wife as unto the weaker vessel. Now what that means, of course, is not that the wife is any weaker mentally, morally or in character. She is not as strong physically. And where does Abraham put her? By his actions? In the house of foreign monarchs where he can't help her. He has not given due weight. That's what that word honour means. He's not given due weight to his wife, Sarah. And God has to rescue her. So I said, brothers and sisters, I get criticised for saying things like, I don't care. I'm sensitive about your feelings, but I'm not going to let your feelings get in the way of the word of God. I'm sorry. It's warts and all. And it has to be that way, because if it isn't, then I'm not going to go away with the correct understanding that it doesn't matter what problems I've got. If I'm prepared to work with God, He can overcome them. Because He did with Abraham. Abraham had weaknesses, like you and I have got weaknesses. And I want God to remove my iniquities. And He did it for Abraham, and if He did it for Abraham, all I've got to do is have Abraham's faith. And He'll do it for me. Don't put anyone on a pedestal, including Abraham. Because God doesn't. You put anyone on a pedestal, you're in trouble. We're all here to be converted. And He's telling you how He's going to do it in a man who failed his own wife. And if He can turn him around, He can turn you around. It's as simple as that. And when people put Him on a pedestal, they lose the whole point of that. Have I said enough about that? I'm sorry. You won't ask me back again. I don't care. I don't care. Too many people today are failing, brothers and sisters, and they're not coming back. They're not coming back. And if they knew what God had done for a man like Abraham, they would come back. The set time. Oh, I didn't finish the story. Stay where you are. 1 Peter 3, verse 7. I'll keep that thing flashing up there so you can't miss the point. Verse 7. Likewise, ye husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honour unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life. Huh? Heirs together of the grace of life? Five's the number of grace. And God puts five. He puts five into the name of Abraham to increase. To increase his numerical value by five. He takes a letter out of Sarah and puts five in its place. He reduces her by five. What does that mean? Well, the net result is 10. She's reduced by five. Abraham's increased by five. 10 just happens to stand for all. And what's Peter talking about? The complete submission of Sarah to her husband when he failed her. He failed her, and she's submissive to him. That's what he's talking about. That shows where we should be in the scheme of things, brothers and sisters. Submission. She showed that submission when her husband let her down. Now we can go to Genesis chapter 17 and verse 21. Probably all awake now, aren't you? Well, let's finish this off in Genesis 17, verse 21. But my covenant will I establish with Isaac, which Sarah shall bear unto thee at this set time in the next year. And we pointed out Abraham was 99 at the beginning of the chapter. In chapter 21, verse 5, he's 100 when Isaac is born. Exactly 1 year. Normal gestation period, 9 months, 10 days, leaves just 2.5 months for the events of Genesis 17 to 20. And in that period, Abraham has to be circumcised. He's painful for a week or so. He has a visit by three angels in chapter 18, verses 1 to 15. Not that long after his circumcision, by the way. Can't be. Sodom is destroyed. Lot's delivered. There's the move from Hebron to Gerar because they can't continue to live in Hebron. It's no longer peaceful. Sarah is in Abimelech's house in chapter 20. And of course, Abraham ends up praying for Abimelech's house and it's healed. And then she conceives. All in 2.5 months. That's what happens. So brothers and sisters, when we come back and have a look at Genesis 18, we're going to see what God does for Sarah. A woman who does not believe at this point that the humanly impossible is possible with God in her case, she's going to find out it's different. Because you see, it's true, isn't it? There is nothing too hard for Yahweh.